Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, the weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome David Trone to the broadcast. David is the co-founder and co-owner of Total Wine & More, a $3 billion privately held alcohol retail company that he founded with his brother Robert Trone. Today, Total Wine & More is the largest independent alcohol retailer in the country, with 172 stores in 22 states. In 2016, David campaigned for the Democratic nomination in Maryland's 8th Congressional District. His unsuccessful bid for the House seat was notable in part because David ran an entirely self-financed campaign. David and his wife run the David and June Trone Family Foundation, whose beneficiaries include education, healthcare, and civil liberties organizations. David serves on the boards of the American University and the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. David earned a bachelor's degree from Furman University and an MBA from the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. I recently caught up with David in his office in Bethesda, Maryland, and our conversation covered world-class IT Principle 1, people, as David discussed the importance of creating a culture of trust and respect to encourage risk-taking and change. We also covered Principle 5, external partnerships, as David described how Total Wine & More weaves itself into local communities to benefit those communities, team members, and the business. David also discussed the evolution of the customer experience in the alcohol beverage industry, his recent unsuccessful bid for a congressional seat, and his favorite wine varietals, among other topics. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you.
This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much.
Trone, great to speak with you. Thank you for taking a little time with me.
That's great to be here and appreciate the interest.
Absolutely. So I thought we'd begin, if you don't mind, with your own beginnings as an entrepreneur. You, during college at Furman, started an egg-centric business, having actually grown up on a farm. You began a beer business while at Wharton as a grad student. And I'm curious, where did your entrepreneurial spirit come from? What were its beginnings?
The entrepreneurial spirit in our family clearly came from my dad. Dad worked at the farm in Pennsylvania. He got involved in lots of different ventures, from egg processing to egg marketing, a hog finishing, a farm vacation business, a gas and grocery business, a picnic business. So Dad was a serial entrepreneur, and that certainly impacted my growth significantly.
And obviously, in the business world, you're best known as the co-founder and co-owner, your brother Robert, of Total Wine & More. An organization now that has, if I've got my data correct, 172 stores in 22 states. You've been around for a little more than a quarter of a century now. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about, as you take the present going forward a couple of years, what are some of the things that are on your roadmap for continued growth? Where do you see sort of strategy in the short and long term?
Well, strategy is going to be both bricks and clicks. Bricks is the where we've been in the past, but the future, of course, has to be clicks. Right now, we're continuing to build across the country. We're focusing on some growth states like Texas and California and filling out some traditional infill markets, Florida, Boston. But at the same time, we realize that with what's happened across retail in America with Amazon and e-commerce, that we've got to really create a great e-commerce solution, be truly omni-channel and agnostic if the customer wants to shop, wants to pick it up, or he wants it delivered. It doesn't matter. We have to do all three and do them seamlessly.
Again, sort of thinking back to the beginnings of this business, two states in which you lived, at least that I know of Pennsylvania and Maryland, both of them have particularly restrictive laws with regard to the sale of adult beverages. And I'm curious, to what extent, I don't know that that impacted at all or influenced your decision to go into the business, perhaps out of frustration for these sorts of things, but I find it kind of interesting that in the crucible of a couple of states that are not so friendly towards, business friendly, I should say, in terms of its regulation, how that has impacted sort of the way in which you think about things, and clearly, of course, how you've thought about expansion and so on.
It's ironic. I was born in Maryland, but we grew up in Pennsylvania at a farm just over the Maryland border. In Adams County, the first store that I built was 1984 in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which was a beer-only store. I did that during my second semester at the Wharton School of Business, where I got an MBA. Problems in Pennsylvania are legendary. Wine and spirits are controlled by the state, which results in a trifecta of high prices, lousy selection, and no service. Everything the consumer dreads, but the leadership politically in Pennsylvania is light years behind the people of Pennsylvania, and they don't want to get out of the way because it's the way it's always been. And a lot of times in politics we see, and in business too, as things have always been, people think they should always stay that way. And one thing we preach, and I talk about all the time, is we have to embrace change. We have to love change. And we got to get really comfortable with failure, because failure is important. The more we fail, the more we, of course, learn. But also, if we don't fail consistently, we're not pushing the envelope and we're not getting triples and home runs. We're settling for a life of consensus, a life of singles, one base hits. So we've got to be willing to step up and take a shot, go to the plate, and realize it's some ideas just aren't going to work, but we have to embrace new ideas.
That's a great point. As you talk about the good portion of the future being clicks in addition to bricks, your traditional business, how do you think, in light of the what we just spoke about, the vast differences across the states in terms of the ability to ship and to do digital business, how do you kind of navigate that political minefield or the different regulations and or even bend them the extent to which you can influence those to any extent for towards opportunity?
It's a tremendously complex field with a tremendous amount of overreaching government regulation. You've really got to know each state uniquely. Right now, you can ship interstate in 14 states, but other states allow intrastate shipping. A lot of time with the lawyers to figure out how to do it the right way. It is a big barrier to entry. It's unlikely that many more states are going to open up interstate shipping because the tax doesn't get collected, whether it be alcohol tax, sales tax, and of course, the jobs are important to each state. And a lot of states are not going to allow interstate because then the jobs would be in a different state. So I don't see a big changes in that. It's a huge, considerable barrier to entry.
Mm-hmm. I'm also curious, you talked again about progress made towards e-commerce and digital business. I know the customer experience is something you're also thinking about, and that's both digitally as well as in stores. Can you talk a little bit about the evolution of customer experience and where you see that going?
Plain retailing, where you have an item, an SKU at a price, and you curate your selection, and you try and work on some modicum of service, is not going to survive in the digital age. At the end of the day, pricing will all be transparent. The smartphone's going to shoot the barcode. We'll know the price at Total Wine and More. You'll know the price at Kroger and at Costco and at Safeway. It's all going to be there. Total Wine always has the lowest prices, so we're the leader. But that just gets you in the door. Selection cuts both ways. We carry 8,000 wines, 3,000 spirits, the biggest selection in America. But for some folks, that's too big of a selection. So we have to curate that thoughtfully and differently throughout America. If we're in Miami, that selection has to be quite different than is in Connecticut or Sacramento, California. But the key is going to always be service. And that's where we have to win in the end of the day. We have to create experiential retailing. It has to be an experience, and it has to be something the customer can't get on the internet. And that means a lot of different things. There's a lot of small touch points that all come together to create an experience. So things like really knowledgeable, highly trained team members, folks that have been to France and Spain and Napa and have lived the wine business for many, many years, decades in many cases. They can really give quality assistance. But also we have to have data, lots of data. We're working on that now through CRM and our loyalty program to have that data right there available on the smartphone so all the service teams know exactly what you buy, what you don't buy, your wife's birthday, your anniversary, your last purchase. It's all got to be there at their fingertips so we can really give high-quality service. But then we've got to have events happening, wine tastings, spirit tastings, beer tastings. We work to change those laws all over America to make it better for consumers. And if we always got consumers-driven, customers-driven, forefront of our mind every single day when we wake up, we can survive. We can prosper. But we've got to create that experience. So the wine tastings are important. Meet the maker events. We bring in brewmasters, distillers, winemakers. Meet the owners. Meet the winemakers. Education, our classrooms. We have dozens of classes on wines in Napa and Sonoma and Australia. Dozens of classes on tequila and bourbon. Dozens of classes on craft beers. So that's a key piece. We do virtual tastings also now, where we'll go through the web, have classrooms in 100 and some stores, tie in with a winemaker in Bordeaux or a Scotch guy in the Highlands of Scotland, and actually get a sense of the place and the person that's behind these great products. Then people can tweak back questions. It can be live. They can taste it at the same time in 20-plus states. We've got to bring video into our stores, and we've, of course, got to have all this up on the web. So we're developing, which has to be and will be, the premier number one alcoholic beverage website in the world, talking about not just craft beer and spirits and wine, talking about how it works with food, letting consumers rate the products. Yes, we need Wine Spectator, Wine Advocate. We need their ratings, but we need consumer ratings. We need folks talking about what they like, what they didn't like, and be able to communicate and connect with their social networks. So there's so much to be done in the stores to create them as an experience. And that's where the future is, because if we're not making experiential, we could go the way of Office Depot, Staples, the list goes on forever.
And I know that not only does better customer experience, your data proves, as other retailers do, better customer experience leads to greater loyalty among customers, but actually educated buyers tend to spend more money on the product as well, understandably, as they have a better appreciation for what an extra dollar will get you. Is that a fair assumption with your business as well?
Absolutely. The more educated the customer goes, they build up the wine continuum. They'll start off with something a little sweeter, a little simple. They'll start with Chardonnay. Move into the light reds of Pinot Noir, then it'll slowly graduate into Bordeaux, then the epitome, of course, is Burgundy, and clearly they're going to spend more money as they trade up the ladder up the chain.
I know that one of your operating philosophies centers around three C's: competition, culture, and customer. I wonder if you can dive into each of those, peel back the onion a little bit, and talk a bit about what each of those mean to you and how they're translated in this organization.
And that's really important. I'm a guest lecturer up at the Wharton School for Business in Philadelphia. Some of the MBA classes there a couple times a semester, and we talk with the kids, and it's really a lot of fun about the three C's, and it all starts with the customer. We shouldn't wake up in the morning and say, how am I going to make a buck? That's a really bad idea. We should wake up in the morning and spend our entire day then thinking about, as Bezos says, the empty chair in the room. That's the customer. How are we going to make it a better experience for the customer? And everything we do has to be aligned and driven about making that experience better in so many different ways. Getting the pricing right, getting the in-store experience right, getting the delivery right. All those many, many small touch points. But the second piece is really more important even, and that's culture. Culture is how we interact with the customer, and that means our team, because our people, our team, are how we touch the customer. So we've got to, as leaders, explain and teach and tell people why. Don't just say do it. Tell them why we do it. Take that extra time to respect your team so they realize that you want their ideas. You want them to be part of a team. And if we're all part of that same effort, we're going to do a better job and take care of the customer. And the third piece, of course, is the competition. At the end of the day, it's us or they shop somewhere else. So we've got to be laser focused on what the competition is doing well and how we can do it better. What the competition is dropping the ball on and how we can leverage and exploit that. So we've got to spend lots and lots of time in our competition all over America. So when I make market visits, you're always in the competition looking to what they did right. And that's, you know, really, really important because we have so much to learn. And it's not just from our direct competition. It's from also being other great retailers in America, whether it be Neiman Marcus or Nordstrom or Whole Foods, all those other retailers that we spend hundreds of hours in other retailers learning and reading about what worked for them and what didn't work.
That's great. There's a fourth C that I know you focus a lot on, and that's charity. Business, you personally spend a lot of money on charitable giving in the markets in which you operate. And I know, of course, that's good first and foremost to those communities. You've also mentioned that it's good for business as well. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that double benefit that one gets in charitable giving in the markets in which one operates.
Now, there's a great book by Adam Grant on that, Give and Take, and talks about givers and takers and where you meet in the middle. But being local is what that's all about. If we're local, and that's just not local wines, local beer, local spirits, but it's local nonprofits, local charity, local community involvement. So we want our teams to be part of the local fabric, whether we're in Tucson or we're in Connecticut and Hartford. It doesn't matter. We need to be part of what's important to that community. So the nonprofits, symphonies to all the various different diseases, autism is a very big issue we work with, epilepsy, longevity, cancer, et cetera, et cetera. We want to be part of all these type groups. We want to attend their events with our people, our teams in each city, and we want to write checks and figure out a way to support them. And by doing that, we are part of the fabric of each of our communities. And that's exciting for our team members. They love that because they realize we're in this for the long term. There's no decisions that we make or just about today or tomorrow, no short-term decision-making. It's about long-term decision-making. And connecting with the community, it's a great thing. It's a great feeling for our team. Last year, worked over 6,000 nonprofits, gave away over $6 million to the company. Then my brother and I and our foundations gave another $12 million away last year to various causes. Things that we think are really important are medical research, things like mental health, things like addiction, the opiate crisis in America, phenomenally important, but also areas like sentencing reform and criminal justice reform. Absolutely, a lot of folks being left behind, especially folks of color, been left behind. And the third piece is education. That's the other nonprofit that we think is really, really important, because at the end of the day, what fixes, sorts everything out is education. We've got to be thinking generational, always thinking about our children. The way that's going to work best is, how do we improve the education? When people are 3 and 4 years of age, we've got to get those folks in school, because starting with pre-K isn't enough. Many folks in lower income areas get left behind. And by the time they get to kindergarten, they're already behind and they're never going to catch up. That's got to happen. But also education for community college. You know, we need to figure out how to have free community college and eventually free college. We're behind the world in the education piece. And you can see it slipping in the world stage, but we compete as businesses in the world stage. And if we don't have a workforce that's diverse and educated, we're not going to be successful.
You mentioned briefly in your response, though, your brother Robert, your co-founder, co-leader, co-owner of this business. As you developed this business with your brother, how did you carve off different spaces? How did you determine, obviously you knew him better than anyone probably in your life, but how did you determine what aspects you would run versus those that he would?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's really important to work as a team again, but also not trip over each other. So it's important to split things up so folks can play to their strengths and have areas that they own and they're responsible for. And we've done that for more than 30 years now. But also we need to work in areas that were uncomfortable. Probably about 6-7 years ago, we actually switched jobs completely in different departments, because that way you get a fresh look at things. You don't want to always be looking at the same stuff. And we need to challenge each other to try those new ideas and not get complacent. The problem we have with a lot of entrepreneurs you see in the world and in America is all of a sudden one day they wake up and said, wow, I've been successful. And as soon as they say that, they start changing how they operate. They become more conservative. And they say, I don't want to risk my success. So they don't take risk. They don't take chances. They don't go for the home runs. They work on too much consensus. And consensus doesn't get us anywhere. If we're all following the same data, we end up in the same place. And that's not going to create true differentiation. So we've got to fight against those impulses to slow down, not push the envelope, not work with speed and trust, to trust your people and try and move fast. And that's a problem as businesses get bigger, $2 to $3 billion as we move through those numbers. We've got to continually keep that entrepreneurial spirit. So Robert and I work on that on an ongoing basis, And that's what leadership, you know, is all about, how to talk the talk and walk it and tell people it's great to get out there and fail. Let's learn and let's move on. Put it behind us.
Very interesting. As we talked about the areas that you're most passionate about with regard to charitable giving, I recognize a number of themes from your run for Maryland's 8th Congressional District last year in 2016. As you point out, it's a place in which you took a risk, and unfortunately for you, it is an area where you failed as well. And I'm curious, number one, why did you get in the arena? And number two, what you learned from that experience as well.
Robert and I realized that for a business to be long-term successful, we can't have leadership that stays on and ownership that stays there until they expire and realize that they're not actually working at 100%. So by stepping aside and bringing in a professional CEO and having a fiduciary board, we're going to be able to move to the next level and perpetuate the business generationally and have ourselves and our children to be good stewards of the business to protect and create great lives for the 6,000 team members we have now and the thousands more we'll hire over the coming years. But the opportunity to step back and work in the nonprofit sector with our foundations, we're very lucky, very fortunate to have that opportunity. But at the same time, my wife and I in the public service area, we're just fed up. We think government is all about themselves. And government should be about the customer. The customer, it's the voter. It's the American people. Government is focused on their brand. Well, the brand might be Republican. The brand might be Democratic. But at the end of the day, we shouldn't be focused on a brand. We should be focused on solutions and making things better for those customers, those voters. Government, driven by being reelected, driven by supporting their brand, that needs to change. In a business perspective that cares about people, cares about our most vulnerable people, most importantly, but also is not just pro-government to help those that are vulnerable, but also pro-business, because business is the engine that creates jobs, that creates health care, that creates retirement plans, that creates the ability to get your children a great education so they can have a life that's a whole step better than what your life was and our lives were. So we've got to embrace business and government as we work together. We're lucky to have the resources to step into the public arena and try and make a difference. I don't need a job. I love business, love going to work. My brother loves business, loves going to work. But we owe it to our team, our families, and if we have the chance to step into public service, it is absolutely the right way to go. We need folks in there that are just there to do good, to make a difference, and work on those important things, education, medical research, certainly the criminal justice system. $80 billion we spend every year on prisons. That's more in most states than we spend on education. That's wrong.
Do you speculate that you may run again for office?
No, I absolutely am going to run again for office. We're already out there now giving talks, different groups, and doing a lot of listening. That's important to meet with people, meet with the activists, meet with everybody to understand what their concerns are, and the solutions are out there. A lot of folks think you get solutions to make your business better or you make your government better from sitting in a room and reading books. And I love to read. I love to look at the pros and the cons. You got to really work hard and dig into the details, and that's great. But the real solutions are in the people that are experiencing the problems, the people that are subject matter experts in those areas. So we've got to be out in the community. It's the same thing in business. You got to be out in your stores, in your factories, to listen to your people that know more about the issues than you'll ever know. And they've lived experiences that we won't have. And we can learn from them the solutions and then bring it back and put it together and then work across party lines. As Americans, not as Democratic brands or the Republican brand, to get stuff done and not just study it and talk about it, but to move. And everyone's not going to agree on everything, and that's okay. But we got to make decisions and move forward. So I'm looking at right now running either for county executive in Montgomery County, or if indeed a seat opens up in the 6th Congressional District, which is not open right now, but if John Delaney, who's our congressman there, and he's an awesome congressman, if he runs for governor, I'll consider that also. So one of those two seats I want to run for, and the key is it's county or it's federal or it might be state at some point. But either way, it's helping government, which is irretrievably broken. People look upon Congress, they look upon government, and they aren't satisfied, and they shouldn't be satisfied because we're not getting what we pay for in our taxes. It's just not working out for everybody. It's only working out for a few people, and that's not right.
I want to end on a lighter topic. I'm curious, are there certain wine periodicals or wine critics that you particularly trust as you look for new varietals, new regions, new places to explore for wine buying and wine enjoying wine drinking?
There's a lot of great authors, books written about wine, but frankly, the best periodical that really addresses wine is Wine Spectator. The Wine Spectator has some great authors. They blind taste everything. It's really a magazine where you can learn about the product and also look at the scoring as they rate different wines. I think they do the best job by far. Another magazine called Whiskey Advocate is really the leading periodical on spirits, and that's a really important business. And we need more magazines and books written about spirits. The spirit business is just exploding. It's actually gaining market share on a national basis of the alcoholic beverage category in the last 10 years. Spirits is even growing faster now than wine. What's growing at a slower speed, of course, is domestic beer. Folks are moving away from domestic beer and, of course, into craft. But overall, those are the two best magazines in the business.
And can I also ask you, are there certain regions that you've become excited with, certain varietals that you've more recently been exposed to that you're enjoying? I'm sure you must have a very broad appetite when it comes to enjoyment of alcoholic beverages.
A personal nature would be a Napa Sauvignon Blanc or White Bordeaux. I think White Bordeaux is something customers just don't understand. But once they try it, it's a blend of Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon and beautifully well-balanced wines. And the reds, Napa Cabernets or Red Bordeaux, or maybe a great Brunello from Tuscany.
Excellent. Well, David Trone, thank you for spending time today. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, thanks again for taking the time to stop by.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategies' five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.